Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Anish Chagpar welcomes lung cancer survivor David Gewirtz. Here's Dr. Chagpar.
Let's start off by you telling us a little bit about yourself and how you were diagnosed with lung cancer.
Well, okay. I actually have been in New Haven for almost 30 years. I spent most of my career working at Yale, actually in technology, working on information systems. My wife is also a local attorney, and I found out I had about cancer in the way that most people find out about lung cancer, and that is I had another complaint, and then serendipitously they found out that I actually had lung cancer. I had bad pain down my leg. I thought it was sciatica, and it was extremely bad, you know, worse than your typical case of sciatica. So I went for an MRI, and from there it was all downhill. They discovered that I had broken my spine in such a way that was indicative of actually, you know, having some kind of neoplastic disease in the lung. And sure enough, they took a CAT scan, and they found, you know, that there actually was a tumor there. And from there, it was rather shocking because 6 months prior to that, my brother had died of lung cancer in 9 months. And it just seemed too incredible that 6 months later, I also was diagnosed. So that's how I found out.
I can't imagine how that must have felt.
Well, it was shocking, and it was unsurreal. Because the cancer took my brother so quickly, and he was actually a scientist who developed novel therapies for hematological cancers using the immune system and knew a lot about genetic profiling of tumors. And there was nothing in the world that could save him. He had access to the best medical care possible, and he unfortunately had a poor quality 9 months of life, and he died. And then 6 months later, bam, it happened to me. And I didn't know certainly as much as he did as a scientist, but I have another brother who was a cardiologist, and he said to me, you know, look at lung cancer is merely a label. How your disease presents may be very different than Alan's. And as it turns out, it really was. I had a very treatable lung cancer where Alan had a very untreatable lung cancer.
So tell us a little bit about what happened then. So you're handed this diagnosis, and it's really surreal. And then how did you... What were the steps that you took that got you into this treatment process?
Well, as I say, we had a year of trying of understanding what goes on from a testing point of view of lung cancer through my brother, who actually knew a lot about molecular biology and biomarkers and things like that. That's what his work was all about. So we had some knowledge of that. And then when I was diagnosed, you know, we asked for the same kind of treatment. And as it turns out, Dr. Lorenz, who operated on my spine, was able to get a section of the spinal tumor that was actually a lung tumor, and that they were able to actually look for genetic markers, and they actually found one, a common one in non-smokers, and that was EGFR, the epidermal growth factor receptor. And my brother also had that, but unlike me, my brother had it in what was called the exon 20, and I had it in exon 19, which was particularly sensitive to erlotinib or Tarceva. And if it wasn't for that drug, I think I would be gone. I mean, I don't think I would be alive. And that drug and has given me a year and a half of high quality life. Actually, it's one of the most best years of my life. And I think it demonstrated, you know, how valuable personalized medicine actually is. And that stems from our understanding of disease, not from a name or a location point of view, but from what's going inside the tumor at a molecular basis.
So it sounds to me like you almost struck it lucky.
I did.
That you were diagnosed, but that they were able to do this molecular profiling, and that there was a drug that was targeted to the mutation that you had.
That's a good question. And we were living in New Haven, and we always knew that Yale was the center of excellence. So at Yale, that was standard protocol. We didn't necessarily have to tell them that. But in many places, many, many places, if you read online some of the blogs, they don't do it. And they blindly give out drugs, you know, like Tarceva. And if it works, well, it works. And if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. But I think that you and I would agree that's a poor way of evaluating a treatment plan for a particular patient and does nothing to advance personalized medicine. So I was very fortunate, you know, to have Yale in my backyard, or also going up to Dana-Farber or the MGH or Sloan. But I didn't really have to do any of that because it was in my backyard. The one thing that I did do was I went to Dana-Farber because my brother knew the top scientist there, and we went there for a second opinion, and they said, you're in very good hands at Yale. We wouldn't do anything different. And so that was quite comforting to know.
And so tell us about your experience. I mean, I still am kind of spinning at putting myself into your shoes. Your brother just passed away of lung cancer. You thought that you had sciatica. Now you have bony metastases from a lung cancer, and you're seeing a spinal surgeon who's taking out a fragment of bone and sending it for molecular profiling. Tell me about your first experience when you actually sat down with the oncologist to talk about this genetic mutation and to talk about personalized medicine. What was that like?
Well, I was in a state of shock and somewhat disbelief. I think it's really unreal. And we were waiting, desperately waiting to get the results on that. And so when we sat down with Dr. Gettinger, he actually said, you know, that we're waiting on the results, but we think, given your history of being, quote, an experimental smoker as a teenager, that it was likely you would have this particular gene and that it would have a mutation, you know, where a drug would be sensitive to. I, of course, just didn't believe anything because my perspective was my brother's perspective, because it was so close in the family, you know, that no matter what, I was going to die in 9 months, and that there was little hope for me. And Dr. Gettinger kept on saying, no, 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 you're not your brother.
Right.
And that allayed some of my concerns, but not many. I mean, I was just destined to go, and as it turns out, it wasn't. And taking a pill, you know, just made it seem even more surreal. He said, well, your treatment is simply going to be some palliative radiation to the spine, and then you're just going to have to take a pill a day. And I said, what? And he said, yes, that's it. You have a perfect, you know, match for a targeted therapy called Tarceva, and you are very, very lucky because it's rare that people like myself actually get that kind of mutation. I think only 5 or 10% of people get it, particularly males. Women get it much more frequently, and I somewhat hit the jackpot. not only did I have the right, you know, biomarker, but I had the right mutation, and it was just so radically different from my brother. So I started taking this drug, and this drug produces terrible rashes. I never received a rash. It's like from the day I was diagnosed, after I got adjusted to it, I've been living a life that's just been perfectly normal. It's amazing.
So your hair didn't fall out?
No.
Yeah. And you felt fine. You didn't get a rash. You weren't having terrible vomiting or all of the terrible side effects we think about when we think about chemotherapy.
Yeah.
And so did you ever wonder, is this stuff really working?
Yes, you do. You do wonder. I mean, for the first couple of months, I was praying that I would get a rash. Just praying that I would get a rash. And I never did. And then 2 months later, I got my first scan. And there was a radical change.
The better.
For the better. And I said, oh, this is interesting. Still did not trust it. I mean, how could you after 2 months? But it was a dramatic, response to the drug. And, you know, I was saying, God, this is even more surreal. This gets weirder by the moment. And actually, when I was diagnosed in June and then I got operated on, the closer to free event was happening in
September.
And I felt good enough, actually, to ride in that event.
Did you really?
Yeah, 2 months after having my spine reconstructed in a 12-hour operation by Dr. Lorenz, I rode 25 miles in closer to free. So it just was, I don't know, they tell me I have lung cancer, but I just not acting like I have lung cancer.
But isn't that great?
Yeah, it is actually great. It really gives you a feeling of hope, feeling that you can live a normal life for however long. And I think that you're not stuck with, well, nothing can be done for me, which kind of, I think, leads to somebody cascading into a deep depression. And for me, it wasn't. It just seemed unreal. That's all for me.
Tell me about your motivation to ride in that bike ride. I mean, here you are. You must have felt triumphant, right? You had lung cancer. You had this surgery. But you felt great and you were going to triumph.
Yeah, I think that was, a psychological way of me triumphing over the disease, that this disease wasn't going to be the end of me, and I was going to resume something that I really loved, and that was bicycle riding, road cycling. And I just said, I'm doing it. And it was a way of taking control of the disease, because my belief really is that what happens biologically, I really don't have much control over. I mean, I had no control over lung cancer. I really was never a smoker. I kept in good shape. Why I developed lung cancer, I don't know. Why my brother did, I don't know. And so I think that riding in the race was just a way for me to say, you know what, I'm going to beat this thing, and I can live a relatively normal life, with this disease.
That is so fantastic. So we're going to take a short break for a medical minute. Please stay tuned for more information about David's experience with lung cancer as soon as we get back.
The American Cancer Society estimates that over 1,000 patients will be diagnosed with melanoma in Connecticut each year. While melanoma accounts for only about 4% of skin cancer cases, it causes the most skin cancer deaths. Early detection is the key. When detected early, melanoma is easily treated and highly curable, and new treatment options and surgical techniques are giving melanoma survivors more hope than they've ever had before. Clinical trials are currently underway at Yale Cancer Center, Connecticut's federally designated comprehensive cancer center, to test innovative new treatments for melanoma. The Specialized Programs of Research Excellence in Skin Cancer grant at Yale, also known as the SPOR grant, will help establish national guidelines on modifying behavior and on prevention, as well as identification of new drug targets. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Anise Chagpar, and I'm joined today by my guest, David Gewirtz. We're discussing his experience with lung cancer. And just before the break, David was telling us a wonderful story of how he was diagnosed with lung cancer, underwent a major operation on his spine, and then just a few months later, cycled 25 miles in the Closer to Free bike ride. David, congratulations on that.
Thank
that was
you.
Just fantastic. And I want to come back to what you were saying right before the break, which is that this really was a way for you to control the disease. There's so many biologic things that you can't control, but you can control how you respond to this disease.
I really believe that you can train your mind to respond to the disease in such a way that you can live, you know, a relatively normal life or not get terribly depressed over your situation. And I think that that takes practice. It's hard work, but it's worthwhile. It's something internal that you have to learn how to do. And then, like today, for example, I know I have lung cancer and it's a terrible disease, but I don't feel that. You know, I feel happy. And I really have to say that the last year and a half was some of the most happier days I've ever had. And that just seems almost impossible, but it really is true.
Yeah. I found very much the same kinds of things with my patients who, you know, have this experience of cancer and it's transformative in their lives. And I think to a certain degree, they realize things about life that they hadn't really realized before. And the other part is that they understand that they can control this cancer and they're not going to let this cancer control them.
Yeah, I think that's right. So I got involved in advocacy work. I was asked, and that was very helpful because, you know, it's a way of fighting the disease. It's a way of giving back. I really believe strongly that the thoracic oncology teams take care of us. But as patients, we have, to the degree that we can help, you know, some kind of obligation to help them, and we can help them through advocacy. So I got involved in the Lung Cancer Alliance in Washington. Prior to leaving, after I left Yale, I worked a couple of years in Washington, and so knew my way around the town a little bit. So I got involved in the Lung Cancer Alliance. And then I don't know who recommended me, but I was asked to serve on the external advisory board and wrote a patient's view of why this research was really, you know, important, you know, for people. And also, I think when you're involved in advocacy work, you know, you're also fighting back and you're also honoring and recognizing people who simply did not make it, you know, like my brother. So, for example, Tuesday, November 13th, is National Lung Cancer Awareness Month, or the beginning of that. And there'll be vigils all across the country, you know, in honoring people who have passed away or succumbed to this disease. And also, it serves as a means to try to get Congress finally to pass the Lung Cancer Mortality Reduction Act, which, you know, is really a framework. It doesn't ask for money, but it's a framework that would lead to the reduction, 50% reduction of mortality of this disease by 2050. And I really believe that if the SPORES program is actually funded, which looks at lung cancer in a multidimensional collaborative way, that, you know, and other institutions also work on this disease, that it might not be so unreachable to reduce the mortality of lung cancer by 2015, because personalized medicine and understanding the biology of tumors, you know, I'm a living example of it. I mean, I would have been dead long ago had it not been for personalized medicine.
Yeah. So just to there are so many things that you touched on that I really think are so important that I want to kind of unwrap. You're quite right. I mean, to think that it was one exon difference between you and your brother and that we have a targeted therapy for your particular mutation was really developed on the backs of so many patients who participated in clinical trials and so many researchers who did this great work. You mentioned being on the external advisory board and the SPORE. Can you tell our audience a little bit about what the SPORE is and what that whole agenda of research into personalized medicine is about?
Sure. Well, SPORE first stands for a Specialized Program of Research Excellence, and I think Yale has always been known for excellence. And each SPORE actually, a SPORE has a package, so to speak. And then in the Yale Lung SPORE, there are actually four projects. And for these four projects, actually, one will look at why people develop resistance to EGFR drugs and, you know, why don't they work after a while? Because if the body didn't have resistance, I could be maintained on this drug for life and I would have a chronic disease, not a terminal disease. The other project that the SPORE is going to investigate, and that is using different kinds of techniques to get people to stop smoking who already smoke. And then the other part, or the other modality that they're going to use, which is a modality that my brother often thought was probably the best, and that was to use the immune system as a means of having cancer cells seen as foreign bodies and having the immune system do what it does best to kill them. And then finally, for people who have very difficult cancers to treat, meaning to say that scientists really don't understand the signaling which causes a cancer cell to divide, they're going to develop something, I guess, with something called microRNAs, and I'm not really an expert on that. I know what it stands for, but that would have been something that my brother Alan, who wouldn't respond to anything, might really try. And so it's those four areas which cut across the spectrum of lung cancer, you know, that they will be looking at. And for me, obviously, understanding why people develop resistance to the EGFR mutation really is really important to me, very important to me.
Well, it sounds like it's such a fascinating portfolio of research, and you can really see how this makes a difference to you and to a lot of people who either have lung cancer or would develop lung cancer, and how, you know, finding those answers could really affect mortality.
It definitely would reduce, you know, mortality. And I think one of the things that's been, I guess, debated, you know, for a long time, but there seems to be some evidence now that in high-risk pools of people CT scans, you know, low-dose CT scans, according to the New England Journal of Medicine, actually does save lives. And so if you can find that cohort and screen them, then not only will you save their lives, but the cost of treatment would be significantly less because although I don't pay for my drug actually costs about $30,000 a month, which is unaffordable to most people unless they have insurance. Right. So, you know, I'm lucky, you know, that way. And with screening, the ironic thing would be that I wouldn't be a candidate for screening. I wasn't a smoker. I was in relatively good health. My mother actually died of lung cancer, but at 90, after smoking for 70 years. So what do you say to that?
Right. Well, I guess it goes to the whole concept that lung cancer is such a multifactorial disease and that it really isn't always just about smoking, although smoking certainly plays a role for many people. But for some people, who they can be non-smokers and they can have mutations. And this is why this personalized medicine and this approach is so important.
Yeah, I think that the spore, what they learn through the spore, you know, will inform, you know, other types of cancers. For example, you know, the EGFR gene and mutations in that gene are not only helpful with, you know, lung cancer, they're also used with pancreatic cancer. So my thought is that over time, personalized medicine or medicine that relies upon biomarkers will kind of change the focus of whether or not you have lung cancer or you have some other cancer. That location will play less and less of importance, and that it's all going to be about the molecular biology of the tumor. And I have to believe, and it's just kind of an assumption, that there are going to be similarities there, and that the and that we'll be able to build off of those similarities so that, you know, better drugs can be developed to treat multiple kinds of cancer at different organ sites.
Yeah, I think you're right. You know, one of the things that I think is fascinating is how proactive you were. I mean, you got involved in an external advisory board. You were in Washington doing advocacy. How do you get involved with all of that? I can imagine that there are lung cancer survivors and other kinds of cancer survivors or families or friends who want to do something but just don't know how to start, where to go, what to do.
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing to do is how I learned all of this is I joined a support group at Yale run by Irene Scanlon and a woman by the name of Linda David. And it was through going to that support group that I learned about these organizations and how people had advocated in the past. And I made a personal decision, really. I didn't have to work, so I don't work. And I felt, you know, that it would be meaningful to my life to get involved in doing advocacy work because I felt strongly that, you know, research dollars for lung cancer, I don't believe are balanced. And the more you know, the more the squeaky wheel gets oiled. So the more we make lung cancer aware to people, you know, in our community and in the nation, the more likely, you know, the government would fund more spore programs like that. And that just became a passion for me and hopefully, you know, for other people. Because that's what's really needed, particularly in a tight market where the economy is making it very difficult, you know, for scientists to pursue their work. So they need all the help they can. And I think the other area where advocacy really is important, and I would like to see a group like Komen for breast cancer for lung cancer that raises just enormous amounts of money, you know, for breast cancer. I'd like to see that done for lung cancer.
Well, you know, Komen started with one patient and her sister who said, let's do something about breast cancer and made a promise that they were going to move that forward. And during the break, you were telling me that that was one of the things that you had talked about in your section for the external advisory board.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's really necessary. It's needed. It's a real, I think, an obligation on our part to raise as much money as we can for the science. I actually called it a pledge, that we would pledge to be advocates for our oncology team. And I think that works, and it's a motivator. And there are a lot of people that actually do that, so I'm pleased about that.
David Gewirtz is a lung cancer survivor. If you have questions or would like to add your comments, visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.